This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we discuss a new EU air safety list and how to tell if an airline has a compliant safety system, claims of a lax safety culture at Horizon Air from Horizon Air, free admission for youth 18 and under at EAA AirVenture Oshkosh, Textron layoffs, space-based ADS-B, and a load stability system for helicopters. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 582 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian. Hey, David.
Hey, Max. I can't believe we've got three episodes left before the end of the year. I don't know where 2019 went, but we should have a good couple of weeks, and then we have our yearly hiatus for the holidays. So I can't believe that's already here.
I know. It's come up quickly. Soon we'll be launching for a 2020, starting another year of Airplane Geeks podcast. Very exciting. Can hardly wait. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Hi, Max.
Hello, Max. Hello, David. And what I can't believe is that we're just 418 episodes away from reaching episode 1,000.
Oh, God. I don't know if I'll live that long.
Wow. Okay.
Oh, see, it's dear. Just around the corner.
Just around the corner. You might even be retired by then, you know?
Oh, dream on.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to jump right into the news, some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
And from the European Union website, Commission adopts new EU air safety list. Well, the EU air safety list details the countries and the specific airlines that do not meet the safety standards of ICAO, the United Nations International Civil Aviation Organization. So entities that are on the list are banned from operating in the European Union, or they may have some operational restrictions within the EU. Now, when the EU air safety list is revised, some airlines or countries, whole countries, can be added, some removed, or the restrictions modified. Now, the new list has, get this, 115 airlines are banned from the EU, from EU skies. 109 of them are in 15 states that are banned due to lack of safety oversight by the aviation authorities in those states, those countries. Then the other six airlines are listed based on safety concerns with those airlines themselves. Include airlines from Venezuela. Well, the specific airlines, Avior Airlines in Venezuela, Iran Airlines in Iran, Iraqi Airways, Blue Wing Airlines, that's in Suriname, Medview Airlines in Nigeria, and Air Zimbabwe. And there's three additional airlines that are subject to some operational restrictions. They can only fly to the EU with specific aircraft types. So it's always an interesting list. I think the value of it for people in general might be that if you're flying internationally, this list can be a good source of airlines that you might want to think about before you book. Just as a bit of advice.
You mean United didn't make the list?
No, they didn't. Although it's interesting. Yeah, I don't know if the 737 MAX is on this list or if its banning from EU comes from a different source. We should know the answer to that question.
Well, I like the list because it's really a good guide as to where you can get bargains on airfares because, you know, they must not charge much. But, you know, the 15 countries for which these 114 airlines or whatever, I mean, most of these are places that you and I are not going to be traveling to. Number one on the list, Afghanistan. I don't know how many airlines they have, but apparently they're not allowed to fly to Europe. Angola, Republic of Congo, Djibouti, you know, which is one of those great country names that always makes you laugh when you say it. Equatorial Guiana, you know, and so on and so forth. So, you know, this is not kind of mainstream, you know, countries with huge volumes of airlines that were, you know, flying in and out of the Western world. So it's probably going to have relatively little impact unless you live in one of those countries.
That's true. Now, you might wonder, well, who decides all of this? Well, for the EU anyway, aviation safety experts from the member states meet under the auspices of the EU Air Safety Committee, the ASC. And that committee is chaired by the European Commission, but it's also supported by EASA and the European Parliament's Transport Committee. But, you know, you also might ask, well, okay, so that's for airlines or countries flying into the EU. What about here in the U.S.? What about the FAA? What do they have to say? Do they have a list? Well, there's something called the FAA International Aviation Safety Assessment Program, and they perform a similar oversight function here. But it differs from the EU approach in that it's slightly more country-focused than airline-focused. And the FAA puts countries into one of two groups. It's pretty simple, actually. They call it Category 1 and Category 2, but it is pretty simple. Category 1 is countries that have acceptable aviation oversight, and they have no restrictions. And then Category 2 is for those countries that don't have acceptable aviation oversight. They have to take corrective measures before they add new U.S. services.
So the United States, according to the FAA, suddenly has become Category 2?
Yeah, I guess, huh? It's worth noting that for the U.S. list, countries disappear from the list after 4 years if they don't plan to fly to the U.S. or code share with U.S. airlines. So if you are, let's say, outside the U.S. and you want to use the EU list or the U.S. list to help guide you with some of these airlines that you might not want to fly in, if an airline is not in the U.S. list, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have good safety compliance. It can mean simply that they just haven't had any activity in the United States for 4 years, so they're off the list. But so you wouldn't want to rely on that. Whereas the EU list is operated a little bit differently. There is a good item if you're interested in this topic. It comes from Condé Nast Traveler. It's titled How to Tell If Your Airline is Safe, and it contains a lot of interesting information. They also list some other sources. One is the International Air Transport Association's Operational Safety Audit, the IOSA. As of the end of 2018, there were 432 airlines in this registry. IATA says that they perform over 150 audits each year. And on that website, we'll have a link to that in the show notes, of course, that website shows which airlines have undergone the audit, as well as expiration dates for those audits. And they also say, IATA says that carriers who completed the audit had a nearly four times better accident rate than those who didn't, at least from 2017. And another resource they list is airlineratings.com, how they rate airlines, but that's based on their own methodology. So there are some resources out there for travelers who may be contemplating flying on some airlines that maybe you wouldn't normally consider mainstream airlines, either U.S. airlines or others around the world. Now, speaking of airline safety, we have this about Horizon Air, which I think this is kind of an interesting item. And Max, I don't think I've ever encountered something quite like this come out of an airline.
It is kind of interesting, especially in light of the conversation we just had. This is a story, and we've got this out of ComoNews.com. Como is a big TV and radio station up in Seattle, and somehow they got their hands on an internal email that came out from the head of flight operations at Horizon Air. Of course, Horizon Air is associated with Alaska Air. They fly mostly turboprops here in the Northwest and the West Coast. And they said in this letter, quote, "If we sit back and do nothing, we will have an accident. Nothing good can come of the trajectory we are currently on." And this email apparently went out to top airline managers and pilot leaders within Horizon Air. And I guess they mentioned, you know, some safety issues that they have had in the past. And they said the incidents range from pilots going over airspeed limits, which is not good. You know, there is something called VNE, which is marked right on the airspeed indicator. And we teach student pilots not to exceed that. So you kind of wonder, how did somebody end up doing that in the turboprop? My guess is that it was probably in a descent. You know, it's pretty easy if you don't monitor the speed carefully that you can overspeed a turboprop in the descent. But still, it's like you'd think with two pilots up front, they should have been monitoring to make sure that didn't happen. They also said aircraft approaching stalls, again, not good unless you're 6 inches above the runway, in which case, you know, that's what you would expect. And they also said that it included weather-induced threats that perhaps could have been avoided. So I guess they're suggesting that some of the pilots got a little too close to some weather, probably, you know, heavy rain, you know, possibly thunderstorms, though we don't have that many thunderstorms in the Northwest. And, you know, on the one hand, I commend them for putting out this memo. And I also would agree that probably in any environment, if you just sit back and you're complacent, yeah, accidents will happen. So, you know, safety really requires proactive action by an organization, and it just doesn't come for free. It comes from constantly paying, you know, attention to details. And I'm sure they probably didn't want this email to get released. I wouldn't say that it means that Horizon is any more safe or any less safe than any other airline out there that's flying the same equipment that they're flying. And if you look at the history, they say the only serious accident they had involving passenger service was in 1988 when a Q400 crash landed after an engine fire. Four passengers suffered serious injuries. Of course, they did have one crash that was not passenger related when someone stole one of their airplanes a few years ago and did some joyriding before you know, putting it into the ground and killing themselves and destroying the airplane. So, interesting little story.
Your description, the description in the article about the issues that they have, bad weather and stalls, all I kept thinking about when I read it was Kogan Air in New York. Wasn't that a turboprop that stalled due to bad weather?
Yeah, wasn't it?
I would say it stalled due to a pilot error. I mean, there's certainly if weather was a contributing factor, but it shouldn't have happened if the pilots had been paying attention.
But it just there's a warning signal there. You know, this is they're pointing out something that has had a serious effect on U.S. aviation for a long time, and it's the same factors somewhat. So it's interesting that Horizon, you know, where they're flying turboprops, Q400s, et cetera, it's preventing Kogan Air reliving itself again.
Well, and certainly any turboprop is not going to be quite as reliable as a turbojet jet aircraft, which is why I said I thought their safety record would be comparable to other airlines flying similar equipment. You know, the problem with turboprops, you're not flying as high. You know, you're down there in the weather, and so you're facing more risk than you would if you were in a jet.
Well, Como News points out that in an interview with the Seattle Times, both this vice president of flight operations, John Hornibrook, as well as Horion's president, Joe Sprague, said that the distribution of the email should be seen as an example of Horizon's high safety standards. There's a quote from the flight operations VP, Hornibrook. He said, "The memo was meant to respond to the spike we saw in irregular events. Also, I'm not sitting back and waiting for something bigger." So I don't know if the flight operations guy and the president started talking about this because the memo was leaked or because they intended to say, hey, look, you know, we're looking at data that suggests that we have a lax safety culture, so we're going to get ahead of this. I don't know, but it's, again, I don't think I can ever remember hearing about an airline executive or two coming out and stating publicly that, hey, we have a, you know, we have a safety culture problem amongst our pilots and we need to address that. I mean, obviously, if that's what you think, you do need to address it. But I don't know what the effect would be on the flying public. I mean, would you be a little less likely to fly on Horizon Air if you had a alternative?
No, I wouldn't. I've flown on them before, and I'll have to tell you, in many cases, you don't have an alternative because they are serving smaller cities. I think I flew them out of, Southern Oregon, Medford. I flew them from Medford to Portland one time. I don't know that you have any other service out of Medford than Horizon Air. And again, I think that all airlines have, from time to time, spikes in, you know, little operational incidents. And, you know, this shows, you know, somebody trying to get out ahead of that, because I think that really is a good indicator. If you start having these little tiny problems, it's like, whoa, you know, that could be symptomatic that if, you know, you don't reverse trends, you could have something even worse. So, no, I would continue to fly Horizon personally.
And what counts next, of course, is what happens next. Does Horizon Air take some actions to address what they see as a potential problem? All right, moving on. This came out, or this was reported in kitplanes.com, and an email came out from EAA, free admission for ages 18 and under at EAA AirVenture Oshkosh 2020, which this was a real good news kind of an item to come across, I think.
I love every aspect about this story. You know, for example, Jack Pelton talks about how they did have some reduced admissions this past year, which I didn't realize, for students, and that as a result, they saw an increased number of families coming to AirVenture. And so now by making it totally free for kids 18 and under, yeah, I bet a lot more families are going to go. I think that there may have been some, you know, people interested in aviation who either didn't go because they couldn't bring the kids, or, you know, went without the kids because it was going to be more expensive. This is just a fabulous solution. And I'd really like to point out that Boeing is partially responsible for this. It's great to see a good news story about Boeing. Boeing is subsidizing the cost of these tickets for 18-year-olds and under that will now be free. And I think Boeing has got it right. You know, we've got to engage the next generation in aviation. We've got to get them next to airplanes. We've got to get them excited about aviation. We've got to show them that, hey, this is a possible career path. And if, you know, people don't see, you know, people like them doing particular avocations, it's hard for them to imagine that, oh, yeah, I too could be an aviation mechanic or a pilot or, you know, flight attendant or any of the, you know, many, many, many careers that are available in the aviation industry. So, man, I just, you know, hats off to Jack Pelton, EAA, and Boeing. What a great story.
Yeah, that's, I agree. I love seeing this kind of thing. And it's an investment in the future. And large companies like Boeing, and this is not a dig at Boeing because this applies to almost every large corporation, but there's often a reluctance to spend money on things that don't have more of an immediate return. This doesn't or may not really have an immediate return, but it's good for the industry. And I think Boeing is to be commended for participating in this way, and for the EAA working with Boeing, I'm sure, to make this happen. AirVenture Oshkosh this year, or well, not this year, next year, 2020, is July 20th through 26th. And I'm planning on being there. Max T, you're probably planning on being there?
Oh, yeah. I'll be bringing my fake ID that says I'm 17.
And how about you, David? Don't know yet or not sure? Or?
I haven't gotten that far yet. Can I get through the holidays first?
Yes, of course.
You want me to make an ID for you, too?
Yeah, please. Okay. Forge my ID also. Remind me to shave my beard before I go, though.
Right. Yeah, they might be on to us.
Let me just mention real quick on this, too, that in our Slack team, and you've heard us talk about that many, many times, probably every episode, if you are not in there, it's organized into what are called channels, different topic areas. And we continue to have a channel that's EAA AirVenture Oshkosh, and it's a great place for you guys, the community here, to interact with respect to this event. Who's going? What are you doing? You know, getting together with other Airplane Geeks listeners or other friends, things like that. Advice on where to stay, or you know, anything like that. Any conversation about Oshkosh can take place in that Slack channel. So if you're not in our Slack team yet and would like to join, just send us an email, thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll get you hooked up with Slack. Next item, kansas.com. Textron filing gives more insight into forthcoming layoffs. So I guess Textron Aviation announced some upcoming layoffs, or announced that there would be layoffs under a restructuring plan, but they didn't provide any details about the size of the workforce reduction. But I guess it turns out there's another way to get a clue as to how many layoffs Textron is planning.
And it came through the Securities and Exchange Commission. Apparently, Textron filed a report with them, which, among other things, said that they plan to eliminate roughly 875 positions. Now, Textron is a conglomerate with a lot of different divisions. The document talked about changes to some of the different segments. And by the way, just to give you an idea of what they make besides, you know, Cessnas and Beechcraft and so on, Textron makes lawnmowers, ATVs, snowmobiles, plastic products, including fuel systems. Unfortunately, apparently, all of these layoffs are in the aviation sector. Of course, no matter, it doesn't matter which sector you're in, it's unfortunate if you get laid off. I would have to guess that part of this is because of the consolidation of Beechcraft. You go back, I can't remember how long it's been. It's probably been a couple of years at this point. Cessna bought Beechcraft, and you'd have to imagine that there's some overlap, and I'm sure they eliminated some of those positions soon after the initial acquisition. But they've probably found some additional areas where they can consolidate. The other possibility, and this I wouldn't be surprised at all, it could be that their business is slowing a little bit and they don't need the number of people that they currently have. You know, the aviation industry is just horrendously cyclical. If you look at employment in any OEM that makes airframes, yeah, that cycles up and it cycles down. I have seen some data over the last 4 to 5 months that says that used aircraft sales are slowing and that the used aircraft are on the market for longer period of time before they sell. I kind of wonder if, you know, that isn't a sign that perhaps, you know, purchases of aircraft are slowing down a little bit. We'll probably have to look at the gamma reports at the end of this year and see, hey, was there any, you know, softness that showed up during the year for new airplane purchases? But certainly in the used market, that activity is slowing down a little bit, all of which is to say, you know, this could be a little bit of a slowdown in sales for Cessna, Hawker, and Beechcraft, which are all owned by Textron.
Of course, the difficult thing with these kinds of restructurings is that the company doesn't want to overreact. You can't just toss people out and then turn around and pull them all back in, you know, at some later date. People move on. You know, you also have issues with maintaining the skills of the workforce when you kind of, I'll say, jerk people in and out. But according to the SEC filing, they say the plan will improve overall operating efficiency through headcount reductions, facility consolidations, and other actions, and that the severance and other related costs associated with this headcount reduction are estimated to be in the range of $40 to $45 million, and which is that seems kind of low to me, at least based on restructurings I've seen in the past. But in any event, a very interesting aspect of this to me anyway is that it says, quote, "We anticipate that the restructuring plan will be substantially completed by the end of 2019. That's just a few weeks away.
Yeah, that means a lot of people are going to get laid off at Christmas time, which I think...
Wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to get laid off at any time of year, but I think it's particularly sad for everybody involved because it's supposed to be such a happy time of year. People often have higher expenses at Christmas time, and to, you know, kind of find out that you no longer have a job, that's a real, you know, kind of kick in the stomach. So it's, yeah, it is sad all the way around. Also, I think that Cessna's business is very heavily concentrated in Wichita. I know they do have a facility down in southern Kansas in Independence, but that they've got far fewer people at that location. So I think this is going to hit Wichita particularly hard. Textron is their largest employer. So yeah, this is just bad news for the city as well. You figure you lose 1,000 jobs, boy, that's gonna probably affect several thousand additional people, both people who are members of the family as well as local businesses that don't sell as many lunches at lunchtime and things like that. So this unfortunately just kind of propagates all the way through the local economy, and this is pretty bad news for the city of Wichita and to some extent Independence as well.
Yeah. I think Textron may be the second largest employer in Wichita. I think Spirit AeroSystems has a few more employees.
Okay.
But in any event, yeah, it's no one likes to be laid off around Christmas time.
No.
All right. Next up, this is from the Washington Post. Northern Virginia-based surveillance firm picks up airline signals to save time and fuel over Atlantic. And this is about Aireon, and they provide a global air traffic surveillance system using Iridium's satellite network for space-based ADS-B. And having this capability offers some opportunities, at least for transatlantic flights.
So currently, the spacing on transatlantic flights is pretty large between aircraft, much larger than it is here over North America. And that's because, you know, we don't have radar coverage out there over the Atlantic. Yeah, here in the United States, separation, I think, in terminal areas, you know, close to a destination airport can be as little as 3 miles. I think when you're out over, you know, when you're en route, it may be as much as 5 miles, maybe a little bit more than that. Over the Atlantic, it can be up to 40 miles between aircraft from nose to tail, if you will. And then the lateral separation side to side is, I believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of 23 nautical miles. So yeah, there just aren't many aircraft, you know, close to each other out there. And I think the FAA is now looking at, hey, is there a possibility to, you know, get some gains in, for example, fuel by helping aircraft fly shorter routes, because now we can put them closer together, which means that they can, you know, they don't have to be as widely separated. I mean, imagine if you've got, and I forget the exact number of tracks, but there may be, what, somewhere between 6 to 9 tracks across the Atlantic. If you could narrow the space between those tracks, then the northbound one is not going to have to go as far out of the way, and the southbound one isn't going to have to go as far out of the way either. So, yeah, it looks like a way that they might be able to compress more aircraft into the airspace that exists and allow a little bit more direct routing. We've talked before how, you know, often gains in aviation are, you know, in fractions of a percent. You know, here's a way where, yeah, they might save another percent or two on fuel, and you multiply that times the, you know, millions of miles flown each year, could be a significant savings.
I think there's increasing imperative for these kinds of ideas that impact the fuel efficiency of flights. And I think we're, you know, as we've said, we're going to continue to see more and more emphasis placed on that, whether the industry wants to or not. I think we may be in a period of many ideas surfacing concerning ways to fly more efficiently. This is one we talked about, speaking of separation, last time we talked about flying in V-type formations similar to how geese fly, for example. And I don't know, in the next few years, we may see kind of a number of interesting ideas crop up that could impact efficiency, and curious to see how many of these actually are implemented, are feasible and implemented as we go forward.
I was talking earlier today with one of my colleagues who also, you know, does aviation writing, and I commented to him. I said, you know, I think this period of time, we're seeing more innovation going on in aerospace than we've seen in many, many years. You know, if you go back to, you know, the 100 years ago, a lot of innovation, a lot of change, the times of the Wright brothers, World War II, and, you know, introduction of jet aircraft, and then things seem to have slowed down quite a bit. There's some innovation around avionics with GPS, but yeah, it just seems to me there's just far more innovation going on every front in aerospace, whether you're looking at kind of the high-end supersonic transports, looking at the low-end vertical takeoff, you know, two-passenger vehicles that'll move you, you know, in your local area, perhaps autonomously. It's just amazing. It's a very exciting time to be around.
Yeah, for sure. All right, one more item from Forbes. This is, after his search and rescue instructor died on a mountain, Caleb Carr, 25, co-founded a company to help stabilize helicopter baskets. Well, this goes back to when Caleb Carr was 15. He was training as a volunteer search and rescuer in Oregon. And as the headline indicates, his instructor collapsed from an apparent heart attack. And the rescue helicopter came in to lift him out of there, airlift him out of there, but couldn't do it.
Yes, obviously this made a big impression upon him, because the helicopter rescue basket was swinging side to side so much that they couldn't get it to go down through the dense forest canopy. And unfortunately, that meant they were unable to rescue his instructor, and he died there on the mountain. And you can imagine that would leave a tremendous impact on a 15-year-old. Well, he decided to do something about it while he was in college pursuing, you know, engineering kinds of courses. He decided to start figuring out solutions. And he actually, even as a, you know, freshman in college, lined up meetings at NASA's Ames Research Center, which is right here in my hometown of Mountain View, California. And he teamed up with other students, and they started working their way through a lot of different potential solutions. What they finally hit upon was using a series of fans that would be attached to the rescue basket and would blow the the basket into a stable position. They also used motion sensors to kind of determine the position the basket was in. And this now has become quite a successful business for them. He is now 25 years old. They've got a significant amount of investment from venture capital, $10.7 million raised. But here's the surprising thing. I mean, I think a lot of people raise $10.7 million. These people actually have $150 million in contracts already with a number of military suppliers. So it looks like they have gone about, you know, solving a pretty large problem that affects just about every aspect of the helicopter, you know, lift industry, if you will. And they've got a solution that apparently scales, you know, up and down from low-end rescue baskets to higher-end, helicopter lift kinds of issues. So just a great, great, amazing story. And of course, Caleb and his co-founder have just been named to the Forbes 30 under 30. So people who are successful under age 30. Great story.
It is. They named the company that they formed Vita Inclinata, if the pronunciation is correct. You say, what does that mean? Well, that's Latin. It's Latin for life by motion, which is pretty pretty interesting. And they call this system the Load Stability System, or LSS. And they say it's platform independent. It's an autonomous unmanned system, and it can control the motion of all types of suspended loads. So whether it's a rescue basket for a person or some kind of a cargo load or something, I guess the system can handle it. It's self-contained. It's modular and doesn't require any power or data from the aircraft or the crane or whatever you're hoisting from. And this allows for the LSS, or load stability system, to be configured for all kinds of mission types. And the fans they're using, they're electric ducted fans, and it stabilizes both oscillations, oscillatory and rotary motion suspended cargo loads. So I think that's pretty fascinating. Max T, you suggested this. This guy Carr, Caleb Carr, or his co-founder, Derek Sikora, these might make some interesting folks to bring on the show at some point in the future and talk about these applications. But I love it, and you said it, Max, that here's somebody who sees a need that's not really fulfilled by anything out there, and developed a solution and has apparently become quite successful marketing that solution. I think that's just terrific.
Yeah, I think the engineer in us really kind of respects people who are able to find solutions to natty problems. I love his quote, by the way, and I think this applies not just to the business he's in. He said, quote, "In search and rescue, I learned real quickly that you can be dead tomorrow. So what are you doing today?"
Ah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very wise.
Yeah. Kind of reminds me years ago when I was working in a division of HP, general manager, having told him about some accomplishment, we made. And he said to me, "Yes, but what have you done for me today?"
Yeah, right.
And later when I was working as a salesman in that part of the company, it was very much that. It's great. You made your quota last month, but today's the first of the month. What have you done today? So.
Yeah. All right, what's up with the geeks? We might not have too much. I know I've been very busy. In the last week and a half, I've driven just under 4,000 miles. And so when it comes to guest scheduling and rescheduling, been a little bit lax recently, unfortunately. So apologize for that. We might go a couple of weeks here without some guests scheduled. But we have some folks already in the hopper for next year and starting in January, and we'll certainly re-energize that coming up so we can continue to bring you terrific guests as many episodes as we can.
Well, let me go ahead and mention that my trip to Knoxville has been pushed out a few days. I mentioned that last week, so I won't be headed out there till Sunday, but on Monday we'll be flying back, bringing a brand new SR-22T from Knoxville all the way to California. So that's going to be my second trip in a couple of weeks. Great fun flying across the country. But also, I am thrilled that my books shipped today. So the new printing of the edition 5 of the Garmin G1000 Glass Cockpit Handbook. So anybody who's interested in learning about the G1000 or the perspective, the books will be back in stock in a couple of days. So I let them run out, and we were missing books there for about 6 weeks, but they're hot off the press and currently being shipped today, so that's great.
And where do we find them?
The easiest thing to do is to pick up the old telephone and call 800-247-6553 and just ask for Max Truscott's G1000 book.
Wow. Who answers the phone? David?
No, we've got we subcontract to a warehouse out in Ohio, and they handle everything for us, which is nice.
Cool. David, have you ever thought about writing a book?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, but that's as far as it gets, huh?
It's what to write, when to write. Part of the manuscript from back to college, I could always dig up, but I'm not sure how much people are interested in Arab-Israeli air-to-air combat. So,
well, you never know. You never know.
Sounds interesting to me.
Yeah, yeah.
As for me, I got to prepare for Santa Claus.
That's right, coming to the helicopter museum.
Yeah, Santa Claus comes into with Santa Claus and Mrs. Claus, hopefully weather permitting, will fly in on Saturday at 11 a.m. So anybody is looking for something to do that Saturday in the area, even if you have a plane and the weather's good, you can fly in and we have a full apron. The other thing I want people to think about is I'm going to have a very busy weekend, Father's Day weekend next year, because I have to spend Friday and Saturdays down at Air and Space Museum. But our Father Fest is Father's Day at the at the helicopter museum. Oh. So I will be driving up early in the morning to get the Father Fest. However, our executive director is thinking about having some more additional aircraft fly in that day. So if somebody wants to think about that Father's Day, if you want to fly in to Brandywine or KOQN, give us a call. We're looking to expand the aircraft and have some other aircraft to make it a family friendly and a aviation extensive thing. Last but not least, after this gets published, the museum will have a new helicopter. Sikorsky has given us an S-76 helicopter with a full executive interior. It was there's been a fight in the office about who's going to take it over as their office. We will have a new helicopter, and my executive director said, oh, you're going to be disappointed that it's going to be a non-military helicopter. And I said, are you kidding? I like S-76s. They're probably one of the most prolific business helicopters. So it'll be another aspect of rotary wing aviation that we'll be talking about and showing people and fighting over whose office it's going to become. You know, those fine leather seats in the back would make one heck of an office.
Any idea what year that is?
No, I don't know all the official details are. It was part of Sikorsky's marketing program, like to show you what the interiors looked like and to show you size. But they are giving it to us. It's not on loan, so it will be our helicopter.
I have a local client who bought a new S-76 in the past year, and it was kind of interesting listening about the discussions on the old S-76 that they got rid of and replaced this. You know, eventually got to, and I don't know how old the old one was. I wish I knew, but apparently it just got to the point where from a maintenance standpoint, it just looked a lot more cost effective to get a new one. I guess as the helicopters get older and older, you spend a lot of hours of maintenance for every hour of flight, and that gets expensive.
Yeah, I mean, it's like all business aviation. It's, you know, a lot of people want the latest and greatest, and the helicopters sort of flow downstream to companies that can't afford the top end, but they'll get, you know, and then eventually they get retired. I believe this is a 10 to 15 year old version, but don't quote me on that. I'll have more details and pictures next week when I get in the office and we get the rotor blades on it. And it's interesting that they've got to completely rearrange the museum for us to be able to put it in there. So it's going to be an interesting challenge for our staff to pull this tractor trailer in and open up the hangar doors and move the helicopters around. And so I'm looking forward to seeing it when I go in the museum on Wednesday.
And is there something you're not telling us? Have you gotten your helicopter license, and are you going to be giving rides?
No.
That was my question.
You too.
Well, with all that, David, you get to plug the museum. What's the website for the museum again?
The website is AmericanHelicopter.museum.
Very good. All right. Just wanted to mention our favorite 13-year-old listener, Zeke, did a school project on the C-130, and he got 105%. Now, I'm not sure how you get more than 100%, but 105% sounds pretty darn good to me. Now, Zeke wrote in our Slack team, he said he did a poster, a 5,000-word essay, around 2,000 words worth of board text. He said then he had two models and a music video. This is on the C-130. Everyone loved it, he said. They got a ton of great comments, and he also credited the podcast in his presentation. So congratulations, Zeke. That sounds really, really wonderful.
That's where the extra 5% came from, the podcast.
Yeah, I figured it was the music video.
Well, and I'm wondering about the music video. Zach, did you make that yourself? I can imagine if the three of us made a musical video, no, I don't think anybody would want to watch it, but that sounds kind of intriguing.
It does. I'd love to see that video, Zeke. So.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. 13, so that's what? Probably about 8th grade, maybe 7th, 7th, 8th, somewhere around there, I'm thinking.
Wow. Very good. Very good. Congratulations. Yeah, I don't know if Zeke is getting a lot of encouragement and support from his parents or not. Hopefully they are, but it's something we can all do, not only just with our own children, but when we encounter other youngsters that have some aptitude or some interest in some aspect of aviation. I think we should look for those opportunities to encourage and support young folks who are doing things like this. I think that's a contribution we can all make.
And I may have mentioned this in the past, but there is an unwritten rule among pilots, and I'm going to say it right here because probably not every pilot knows the rule. The rule is when you're in an airplane and you're taxiing by and you happen to see some kids, you are required by law to wave at those kids because they get really excited and they wave back. I'll tell you what I do. I'm lucky because usually I'm in the right seat and someone else is doing the taxiing. I'll actually open the door so that they kind of got eye-to-eye contact with me. And then I'm waving my arm, you know, as kind of far as possible. Almost always they see, and if they don't, parent kind of points them in the direction and goes, "Hey, look, they're waving at you." And I think it's important. I think it probably just gets the kids a little bit more excited about being at the airport and makes them just a little bit more likely to, you know, perhaps pursue a pilot license or to get somehow involved in the aviation industry.
Yeah, that's perfect. I love that. All right, on to a little bit of listener mail. Mason wrote us. He said, "I started listening to the show a couple of years ago when I was working toward a career change. While in school, I had the opportunity to take a fun class, airline economics." That does sound pretty cool, but get this. The class was, and still is in existence, taught by former Spirit Airlines CEO Ben Baldanza. He says, "We got to learn all about the business of the airline industry. One of our guest speakers that semester, Seth Kaplan, had a podcast about the airline industry. And in fact, the two of them, Ben and Seth, do produce a podcast.
It's the Airlines Confidential Podcast.
And speaking of potential guests for this show, maybe we can rope one or both of them into coming on and talking to all of you. You can look for that. We'll have a link to that in the show notes, that podcast. But Mason goes on, "While I was starting to listen, I searched for other podcasts. Then I was fortunate to discover the Airplane Geeks podcast. I have almost caught up with every episode."
Well, good thing for him, we're not up to 1,000.
Yeah, I know. Well, that doesn't mean almost every episode since the start of time or just when Mason became aware of us. I hope it's the latter.
Well, you remember when we did that first one right after Orville and Wilbur flew, right?
Yeah,
right. Our very first podcast.
Mason says, "Unfortunately, my podcast listening time dwindled until recently, but for the past month or so, I've gotten back to listening on my commute to work in the Northern Virginia area." Okay, my ears perked up, and I'll tell you why in a second. "I live about a mile or so from Dulles." Oh, and my ears really perked up. "So I get to see all kinds of airplanes taking off and landing. I just wanted to say hello, and I really enjoy listening. I hope someday to start working on taking flying lessons and getting up in the skies much more often. But for now, I'm confined to the simulator on the PC. Thanks for reading and doing what you do." So, Mason, we look forward to seeing you next June at the Air and Space Museum there at adjacent to Dulles Airport for the annual Innovations in Flight Family Day, which we attend every year. Hopefully they'll invite us back again next year in 2020. But that's, and David mentioned this before in the show, but that's always the Saturday before Father's Day, Father's Day being on Sunday in June. And we always have a lot of listeners and fans and friends attend that event. And as those of you know who've done this for the last number of years, we always have a dinner after the event where we just get together. It's always been at the Red Robin restaurant that's close by Dulles, and have some burgers, some food, some beer, some drinks, and some fun. So we hope, Mason, you'll be able to join us in June 2020. Patrick Wiggins sent us an email. This just showed up. He says, in a newsletter I receive from the company that insures an antique car I own. Do we know what antique car Patrick owns? I don't think we know. Patrick, what is it? Now I'm really interested. But here's what was in this newsletter. It's a link to an item at Hagerty.com. Rare 1954 aero car may fly off the auction block at Scottsdale. Patrick says, looks neat, but I'm sticking with my 172. But this 1954 aero car, this is like, I don't know if it's the, David, is this the original flying car? It's got to be pretty close to it.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure that it's the one that they actually restored and they actually flew it at Oshkosh a couple of years ago.
No kidding.
Yeah, this is the one where the wings were removable and then you could trailer them behind the car, which is just amazing. Yeah, that you know, you can take the wings off and suddenly it's the width of a car and it still moves all the parts along with it.
So this aero car was formerly on display at the Golden Wings Flying Museum in Minneapolis, and it's being offered without reserve and without a pre-auction estimate. Now, notes that it's been offered for sale at least twice in the past for $1.25 million in 2012, and more recently for a bargain $895,000. So if you're interested in that, take a look at Hagerty.com and that auction. You know, 1954, that's 65 years ago. We had a flying car 65 years ago.
Even earlier than that, if you talk about rotary wing, the Pitcairn Rotable, which which was built at Willow Grove, something about that base that I know nothing about. Built was actually driven down, you know, Pennsylvania Avenue. It's very famous and still exists. It's located at the Air and Space Museum at Dulles.
Oh, okay.
But that's like 1936.
Wow.
Well, and we're getting real close. I mean, we certainly have talked on this show about the Terra Fugia, the transition. That's been under development for more than 10 years. I think we had some of the principals here on the show a long time ago.
Yes, we did. I don't
recall if that is shipping yet. I don't think it is. But it's a challenging problem. Because to meet both, you know, FAA rules and highway rules, you end up adding a lot of weight to the car. And, of course, airplanes, you know, don't like having a lot of extra weight. And then that drives the price up and that drives the volume down, which further drives the price up. So, yeah, it's a tough problem, I think, to, you know, design a flying car that will be successful. Because, you can certainly design one. But the question is, how many of them are you going to sell?
Yeah, it's a good point when you talk about needing to meet the requirements, the regulations for both aircraft and for land vehicles. At least for the aircraft portion of that, regulations, I guess, are pretty much established. The task is marrying those two independent requirements, air and land. But when you look at urban air mobility, then the vehicles being designed there, you don't have the land-based transportation regulations to deal with. You only got one set, But that one set, the aviation part of it isn't really established yet, or not completely established yet. So you have that challenge as well. So I don't know what's tougher, the flying car challenge or the urban air mobility challenge.
Well, when you were reading the letter earlier from Mason and he talked about taking his class on airline economics, I was thinking, hey, that's pretty simple. You take a large amount of money and usually it becomes a small amount of money. I mean, that's pretty basic aviation or airline economics.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, one more from, this is from Roland. He said, thanks for your fantastic podcast, which I've been listening for many years. Since you mentioned paramotors in the last episode, I've been watching videos from a guy named Tucker Gott. He flies his paramotor in nice locations while filming and commenting. It's just very pleasant and enjoyable to watch and sometimes funny. And Roland sent us an example, a video on YouTube, flying through the Corona Arch. And it's, these paramotors, these paragliders are, I don't know, I'm just finding them increasingly fascinating since I've sort of rediscovered them in the last few weeks. And just the perspectives you get from, flying low altitude in a paraglider, parawing, paramotor. This guy, Tucker Gott, has got a lot of videos. It seems like he's kind of a character, but my comment to Roland was maybe I'm not sure, Max T, how much you would advise people to fly this type of device, this type of aircraft, through an arch like we see out in the, in Utah, I guess, primarily, but some other places in the desert southwest, I guess, primarily.
Yeah, I was looking at the video, and it was kind of fun to watch him fly through this large rock formation. You know, I looked briefly at these, probably 10 plus years ago. And the thing I hadn't really considered was, that engine and that propeller is essentially on your back. And you look at how far that away is from your ears. Yeah, it's going to be a really loud, thing to be doing. If you could tolerate that, then sure, what the heck? It looks like it'd be a heck of a lot of fun.
It does. It really does. But I'm happy to watch videos of other people having really fun. I'm not particularly inclined to take it up myself, at least not at this point. Mm. Oh, dear. All right. Well, that's it for this episode. I know it's a little bit shorter, quite a bit shorter than we normally run. For those of you who love the long-running episodes, apologize for that. Of course, as always, you can find us at airplanegeeks.com. There you'll find show notes for this and every episode. But if you're looking for this episode specifically at some point in the future, you can get to it pretty quickly by visiting airplanegeeks.com/582. As always, you can reach us via email at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. We also encourage you to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already. For those of you who are new to podcasting, the subscription price is zero. There is no, unlike other subscriptions you might sign up for, there's no cost to subscribe. But what that does is it will cause your podcast app to automatically display, if not download, the episodes as soon as they're released. Well, let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And David Vanderhoof, let's start with you.
You can find me on our Slack listener team. And if you haven't got the impression that we'd like you to be there, send us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com and we'll send you an invite. Likewise, if you can spell Vanderhoof, you can find me on Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn. And last but not least, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about UAVs on the UAVdigest.com.
That's right. And Max Trescott, where do we find you?
Well, I want to mention that this week on Aviation News Talk, episode 132, which is, what, 868 until episode 1000. The show is all about getting pilots to slow down to both reduce risk and improve performance. So I tell a number of stories, quite a few of them, of situations that I've encountered where people are rushing a little too much with detrimental effects. So really, when you're in the airplane environment, please slow down. So check that out if you want at aviationnewstalk.com. If you want to reach me from that same website, you can go to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact at the top of the page, shoot me an email, or click on listener questions, and you can record either a listener question, or this is something that we've started new in the last couple months, a fun flying destination. Just take 90 seconds or less and tell us about your favorite place to fly and what's special about that airport and what you can do when you're there.
Great. And you can find me, just look for Max Flight in LinkedIn, on Twitter. Also, as David mentions, at the UAVDigest.com, and also with Mary Kirby talking about the passenger experience at PaxXPodcast.com. So with all that, we'll ask you to please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.